Hey folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs, made for awesome humans. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. Hey, ACRackers, we have a fabulous new sponsor, and this one is near and dear to my heart, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can get target weak areas or take longer or shorter practice exams anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has the CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off a 90-day or longer SmartBank subscription. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaugh, and I'm thrilled to have with me today Dr. Christina Miller, who is one of our neuroanesthesiologists here and the medical director for the electroconvulsive therapy group in charge of doing anesthesia for ECTs. And so today we're going to talk about anesthesia for electroconvulsive therapy. Also happy to say that this episode is going to be featured at anesthesiologynews.com. Frequent listeners will know that anesthesiologynews.com features a bunch of our episodes. You can check them out over there at anesthesiologynews.com as well as a bunch of other great content that they have there. All right, Dr. Miller, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to talk, as I said, about anesthesia for ECT, but let me start by asking you, what is ECT? It's electroconvulsive therapy, but what does that mean and kind of where did it come from? What's the history of this thing?
Well, ECT is a controlled generalized tonic-clonic seizure. In modern times, we do this with the aid of anesthesia. In the past, in ancient times, physicians like Galen and Hippocrates noted that there were improvements in psychiatric symptoms after patients had seizures that were related to other illnesses such as malaria. And so this gave the psychiatry community the idea that perhaps they could treat psychiatric illness. Primarily what we're treating is major depressive disorder, but there are some other indications for ECT as well, that you could treat this with inducing a seizure. And in the 1930s, they would use medically induced seizures, things like hypoglycemia from insulin or other uncommon medications that we don't see today. But in the 1930s, they began using electricity to stimulate seizures. And initially, this was done without any sort of medical adjunct, no sedation or anything like that. Seizures, the seizure process isn't painful, but unfortunately, there were significant complications associated with it. So when you have an unregulated generalized tonic-clonic seizure, you're at risk for things like shoulder dislocations, injury to the teeth, lips, gums, a lot of lumbar compression fractures because the back muscles are much stronger than the abdominal muscles, and there's this sort of phenomenon where the patients would arch backwards and have injuries secondary to that. In the 1940s, when Curare became available as a long-acting muscle relaxant, there was some experimentation with using that to blunt some of the motor response, with the thinking that you could attenuate skeletal muscle contractions but still maintain spontaneous respiration. And because this is a long-acting drug, as we know, there were more respiratory complications as a result of that. In the 1950s, when succinylcholine became available, this was a much shorter acting muscle relaxant, and so the respiratory depression was much shorter lived, and patients didn't have as many complications. But there was a lot of anxiety around this feeling of suddenly having a rapid, profound paralysis and not being able to breathe or talk. And so, as one of the psychiatrists, Max Fink, said, you know, we didn't really want anesthesia specifically for ECT, but we needed anesthesia so that people would not recall the experience of paralysis with succinylcholine. Mm. Unfortunately, most of the medications that we use in our anesthetic armamentarium tend to raise the seizure threshold, and that makes it more difficult to have an effective treatment. And so this is a very interesting area of anesthesia practice for me because it requires a lot of manipulation of the pharmacology that we give in order to still achieve a good treatment, and there are a lot of physiologic effects as well. I feel like it's one of an area where we have a direct impact, the anesthetic technique and the medications that we choose, the doses that we give, and the effectiveness of our ventilation has a direct impact on patient outcomes.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was telling you before we started recording that I remember very well as a resident really enjoying the experience in my ECT rotation and feeling like there's a lot to learn and it's very different from what you do in other rotations. So I think that's fantastic. So you had mentioned before that one of the indications for ECT is depression. Tell me a little more about that, and then if there are any other indications.
Yeah, ECT sort of fell out of favor in the 1960s and 70s because there were a lot of very effective antidepressant drugs that were developed. But not all depression is responsive to medication, and many of the patients that we see have profound refractory depression and have tried multiple agents, multiple types of therapy, and this is one of the only treatments that they respond to. So there's been a resurgence recently in the last couple of decades, though there's still a huge amount of stigma and controversy surrounding ECT, which is steeped in myth and not really supported by the evidence that ECT is a very, very effective treatment for many of our patients.
Great. So certainly depression, as you said, and maybe severe depression.
Yeah, depression. So there's unipolar depression where patients just have depressive symptoms. There's bipolar depression where patients have depressive symptoms but also manic symptoms. Mm-hmm. There are elements of depression that have some psychotic features that can be helped by ECT. And we also treat a fair number of patients who have catatonia. So this is sometimes related to depression, sometimes not, but where everything just becomes so profoundly depressed and slowed, movements, oral intake, patients become almost stuck. And the first-line treatment for that is benzodiazepines, and many people respond well to that, and that's the only treatment that they need. But in some cases, they may respond briefly or just partially, and then that suggests that they may respond to ECT. So we've had quite a number of patients that I've seen over the years who've had a really dramatic response after getting ECT for catatonia, and this suggests that, you know, there's a GABAergic sort of mechanism that's behind the effectiveness of ECT.
Interesting. Okay. And so depression and then this kind of severe form, which is catatonia, and then are there other kind of psychiatric diseases that it works for?
Yeah, there are some, I would say a very, very small percentage of the patients that we see sometimes have issues with eating disorders. We've treated a patient with profound obsessive compulsive disease, a patient who had really terrible refractory Tourette's that was helped by ECT. And then there is a small group of patients, generally pediatric patients with autism that's so severe that they have a lot of self-injurious behaviors and are at risk for harming themselves and potentially others as they grow older. And we have a small group of maintenance patients who receive maintenance ECT on a regular basis, and it really helps them be able to integrate well with their families and with their community. And without this treatment, their behavioral issues would be so profound that none of this would be possible.
Really interesting. I wasn't aware of those other indications, but that's really interesting. So what's a usual course of treatment? If I remember right, it's not just one time, right?
Sometimes people feel better after a single treatment, and that's a wonderful suggestion that they're going to improve with ECT. But typically, if patients have an acute course of ECT for depression, we average around 6 to 12 treatments. And every institution is different, but here we do ECT 3 times a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so over the course of several weeks, patients usually recover. And they may feel better after the first treatment, or it may take several treatments until they start to notice a difference. There are patients who have much more refractory disease and they require a much longer treatment course. And then in addition to that acute course, there are applications for ECT to be used for maintenance. And this, maybe every month, every 2 weeks, something like that, or perhaps just when they see their outpatient psychiatrist and begin feeling like their mood is beginning to slip and they need something added to their treatment regimen. And this, for many people, this can be very helpful in keeping them out of the hospital as an inpatient. Some patients have insight into when this is happening, and they actually seek extra treatments out. And for other patients, they have less insight into their illness. Depression is very complicated in that way, in that it's sort of a gradual erosion of your insight into your own problems. And so they may be referred back to us by their outpatient provider.
Okay. So let's turn to the kind of anesthetic preparation. If you are knowing that you're going to be doing a day of ECTs, you're going to obviously want to think about your preoperative planning for your patients. What do you think about in terms of preoperative concerns?
Well, the procedure itself, what it involves is that we typically induce with a hypnotic agent, a short-acting medication called methohexital, followed by a short-acting medication or short-acting muscle relaxant succinylcholine. And at that point, then once the patient is anesthetized and then relaxed, we begin to hyperventilate them for several minutes until we trigger the seizure with an electrical stimulus. When the seizure is triggered, we see profound stimulation of the autonomic nervous system, as well as all other parts of the brain, but the motor activity is attenuated by the succinylcholine. And so my primary concern is how the patient is going to respond to these autonomic changes. Typically, what we see first is a parasympathetic response, and so we get bradycardia, sometimes a systolic pause, a brief slowing of the heart rate, and then you can see increased secretions, you can see bronchospasm, and that is a pretty brief response and followed closely by a profound sympathetic response. And so in patients with cardiac disease, pulmonary disease, we become more concerned about this profound hypertension and tachycardia. By systems, the things that I'm thinking about from a neurologic standpoint, I look at whether or not they have an underlying issue with seizure disorder to begin with, things that would make them respond in an unusual way to ECT, if they have a focus for epilepsy already, if there's any sort of organic findings in the brain, brain tumors, and brain aneurysms are particularly concerning because we are going to put a lot of shear stress on that aneurysm with the sympathetic response. So we look at that first, and then we also look at what psychiatric medications they are on. There are things that anticonvulsants clearly are going to inhibit a good treatment, and we need to taper those or hold those before treatment. But even things like perhaps if they're using Tegretol for facial pain or something like that, things that have some anticonvulsant properties, we would want to be aware of that.
And Tegretol is carbamazepine?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly history of stroke is concerning and puts ECT could put patients at increased risk for complications from that. We don't have very good data to determine how soon after an ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke we can treat patients. Typically with an elective procedure, we might wait up to 9 months after an ischemic stroke, but there's usually more urgency associated with the indication for ECT in terms of patients' quality of life and perhaps even risk for suicidality. So in a conservative case, you would wait 9 months, but usually we wait about 3 months after ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke, but there's not a lot of good literature to guide us on this.
And is there anything you do differently if someone has, let's say, 3 or 4 months ago they had a stroke? Would you sort of do anything differently to more tightly control the blood pressure?
Yeah, we do blunt heart rate and blood pressure response with a variety of short-acting medications. Typically, we use Esmolol, nitroglycerin, and if they have more sustained sympathetic response, maybe labetalol. For sicker patients, there's certainly an attempt to more tightly control those parameters with short-acting, easily titratable medications. But the risk is still there, and the sympathetic response is very profound and refractory to treatment.
Okay.
In some cases. That being said, that sort of leads me to my next point about a cardiac disease. We need to make sure patients are able to withstand a profound sympathetic discharge. Patients who have coronary disease, myocardial ischemia, valvular heart disease, where any profound increase in afterload or heart rate would be concerning, those are patients that we want to optimize beforehand. We also sometimes have patients with pacemakers or AICDs. With pacemakers, the concern is that the repeated electrical stimulation may have an impact on battery life.
Okay.
And so what we typically recommend for that is interrogation before the course of ECT and then after the course of ECT to make sure that the battery life is sufficient.
So not after each one, but
after they've finished their course. Yeah.
Gotcha.
With AICDs, there's a very, very small risk that the electrical stimulus could be interpreted as an arrhythmia and cause the AICD to fire inappropriately, though there's very little evidence to show that ever happens. Our sort of conservative approach with that is to turn the AICD off for each treatment and then have it turned back on after recovery is complete.
All right, so that's all really important to know. And then let's see, other organ systems. How about the pulmonary system? Anything there?
Right. So we're going to be doing quite a lot of hyperventilation.
And why is that? Why do you
patients?
Hyperventilate?
So as I mentioned before, a lot of the medications that we use to provide anesthesia raise the seizure threshold. And one way that we can compensate for that is to hyperventilate patients. So we blow off the CO2, we increase the pH in the brain, and everything is a little bit more irritable. And when we hit it with electricity, everything's a little bit off kilter and you get a much better response.
Okay.
The other thing that we try and do, particularly in patients where we're having a difficult time achieving a good treatment, is that we are actually waiting almost for the emergence, sort of the equivalent of phase two phase, where the patient is emerging from anesthesia and entering that sort of excitement phase, not yet conscious. But again, we see this certainly in other areas of anesthesia where you have that in between unconscious and awake phase, and things are things like bronchospasm or, airway reactivity are more prone to happen. And so everything's just a little unbalanced. And when we hit the brain with electricity, we get a better result.
So you want to be kind of cognizant that all of that is potentially going to happen and be ready for it.
That's right. That's right.
How about it from a GI perspective? Are these patients going to be full stomachs, prone to vomiting?
All of these patients are fasted beforehand. What we are typically doing is mask ventilating without a secure airway. We do ventilate patients in a semi-upright position with the head of the bed elevated. We typically use oral airways to try and increase the effectiveness of ventilation, but also potentially decrease stomach insufflation. It's rare that we have patients who have severe full stomach precautions where we would not be able to do this under mask ventilation. But certainly we want patients to be fasted, patients who have gastroparesis, patients who may have ascites from liver disease or other reasons for delayed gastric emptying are of concern. We have done anesthesia in patients who are pregnant, and typically we'll do mask ventilation up to through the end of the second trimester, but not in the third trimester. That presents too much of a risk.
Okay. Are there absolute contraindications to doing ECT?
I would say that they're limited. There are many relative contraindications. Active untreated pheochromocytoma would be certainly something that we wouldn't want to provide ECT in that context. And then, as we discussed, recent MI, recent stroke, the risk benefit analysis with ECT is always very interesting because these patients are typically profoundly depressed, maybe suicidal. And if they are not able to get effective treatment, their quality of life is very poor and their potential for death is very, very high, either by their own hand or because they're not able to effectively manage their medical comorbidities in an organized way. So that very high stakes environment has to be weighed against whatever risk the anesthesia and the ECT itself present. And we have, long detailed conversations with families about what we can do to modify risk, but not eliminate it completely. And many patients, even with significant comorbidities, choose to go ahead and are treated safely, despite the fact that that medically they have a lot of concerning issues.
Sounds good. How about relative contraindications? Things just to kind of keep in mind, but that don't necessarily rule it out.
Coronary disease, COPD is another, profound lung issues. We have to be careful. We spoke earlier about pulmonary disease. Patients who have a lot of emphysematous changes and may have blebs, we have to be careful with airway pressures and that sort of thing. We have treated patients who have head and neck cancer, who have ongoing concurrent radiation treatment. There are many things that we need to be cognizant of, cardiac, pulmonary, neurologic disease that increase risk, but typically can be optimized and overcome.
Okay. And so what are your anesthetic goals when you are getting ready to do an ECT?
Well, this is a very quick procedure, and we do many of them in the course of a day. So we want to provide rapid unconsciousness and muscle relaxation for the stimulus itself. We want to provide hemodynamic stability, which is in the face of our anesthetic drugs, but more importantly in the face of these autonomic, the stimulation of the autonomic nervous system with ECT. And then we want to provide a fast recovery and get patients awake and able to breathe on their own and hemodynamically stable after the treatment. So all of that is sort of the anesthetic part of the goal, which is not unusual to other areas of anesthesia care. But in this instance, as I've alluded to many times already, the issue is that most of our anesthetic agents depress seizure activity, and that's not desirable in this case. And so we use certain combinations of medications in certain doses, and we augment with hyperventilation in order to overcome that effect.
Great. And I want to ask you about the typical drugs and dosing, but I have one question, which is that I remember we used to put a tourniquet around one leg, and so the succinylcholine didn't get to that leg, and you could see the seizure. Is that typical? Was that always done?
So that was definitely common practice in the past. We have a very rudimentary EEG that has two leads, and so we can determine seizure activity from that, even if there is no motor manifestations because of the succinylcholine. Every once in a while, the blood pressure cuff inflates at just the right time, and we see that that hand or that limb moves more than the rest of the rest of the body. They also inflated the tourniquet. I think in one of the other reasons we did that was a concern for awareness, so that even if the patient were relaxed, that with one hand or one foot, they could still indicate some sort of responsiveness. And awareness is a big concern. We do our best to minimize that as much as we can, but we are always trying to provide the lightest anesthetic possible, right, so that they don't have recall of the experience, but also that we're facilitating a good seizure and actually contributing to their improvement.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's say someone comes first time. They've never had an ECT before, so you don't have a prior anesthetic to go by.
Right.
What's your go-to? What are you going to use for them?
So our initial drug that we use for hypnosis is methohexital, and that's a short-acting barbiturate. And it is dosed by weight, I would say 1 to 1.5 per kilo. And this is dependent on lean body mass, and sometimes I make alterations up or down depending on the patient's age. And that's pretty rapidly acting. Once I've confirmed that they're unconscious with that, then we give succinylcholine. Again, 1 to 1.5 per kilo. And after that, we begin our hyperventilation and do the ECT treatment. For many patients, they may have methohexital or Brevetol and succinylcholine as the only induction drugs throughout the course of their treatment. But for some patients, repeated stimulus with ECT raises the seizure threshold, makes it more difficult for them to seize, and then we have to make manipulations in the doses of those drugs. So if possible, we can titrate down the Brevetol dose, but when we sort of meet the come up against the risk of inadequate loss of consciousness, then we have to find another way to augment their anesthetic dose. And here what we use is remifentanil. So typically that can be given upfront as part of the induction process. And then once that sort of reaches its peak effect, we can give a much smaller dose of the Brevetol, even an excitatory dose of the Brevetol. And together in combination, the remifentanil plus the methohexital help us achieve unconsciousness, but with a much lower dose of a medication that suppresses seizure activity.
Interesting. So what is an excitatory dose? That's just a smaller dose of methohexital that actually can paradoxically...
Paradoxically, yeah. In smaller doses, methohexital can paradoxically lower the seizure threshold, okay, or increase the ability to seize. Mm,
yeah. Interesting. Okay. And then remifentanil, of course, being so short-acting, is nice. It's not going to cause post-operative respiratory depression.
It doesn't cause long-term post-op respiratory depression. We do use it in large doses, and the things that we are looking out for are bradycardia, hypotension, chest wall rigidity,
yeah,
which can be profound because this is an arena where we're using very high bolus doses of remifentanil, 200, 400, sometimes 1,000 mics at a time in the upper limit in order to achieve our goal. And even though it is a short-acting drug, very, very large boluses can still have a longer effect,
sure,
than you might expect. So those patients that we treat with remifentanil, especially for the first time, we watch a little bit longer in the procedure room in terms of their respiratory drive and their recovery from respiratory depression from that.
Now, if you see the chest wall rigidity, you're going to be fine while your succinylcholine's on board, but is it possible that when your succinylcholine wears off, you might still be unable to ventilate?
I haven't seen that before.
Okay.
We see chest wall rigidity up front, and then we see a profound difference once the succinylcholine takes effect.
Okay.
We haven't had issues with prolonged chest wall rigidity that I'm aware of.
Good. So the issue would be just realizing that if you're not ventilating, you got to get that succinylcholine in, and
right,
and that'll help. All right.
Right. Timing is everything happens within a few minutes,
right,
but just a matter of a few seconds here or there, timing wise can be profound.
Absolutely. All right. So let's say there are obviously other drugs. What would make you say, all right, well, actually, I'm not going to do methohexital in this patient. I'm going to use something else? Or what other drugs might you consider and why?
So historically, other things that have been used have been things like thiopental, etomidate, ketamine, propofol. All of these have a less favorable profile when it comes to their impact on seizure threshold, seizure duration, and also hemodynamic stability. In rare cases, I think the only contraindication I can think of is porphyria for thiopental, for methohexital.
Okay.
Or allergy, though I can't say I've ever seen that. And for a patient that we had who had porphyria, we did use low-dose propofol.
Okay.
And many places do use low-dose propofol. And if titrated appropriately, you can still have adequate treatments. But we tend to see a lot of patients who have more refractory depression and potentially are referred from other places, and we are we're treating some of the more difficult cases, and we find that methohexital gives us an advantage over propofol.
Great. So propofol could be used if needed under those circumstances.
Yeah,
etomidate, you mentioned, has been used in the past, obviously has the adrenal suppressive side effect. Is there any time where you might opt to choose etomidate, where you might prefer that? Is there any advantage?
Because of its hemodynamic stability, if you had patients, I suppose, who are prone to hypotension, it might be desirable.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that when you get that sympathetic stimulation afterwards, now you are starting with a higher blood pressure, and sometimes
right,
you can see more a more exacerbated sympathetic effect afterwards.
So I imagine ketamine probably has similar potential to cause almost an increase in blood pressure, or at least not to attenuate the sympathetic response as much. Are there other disadvantages to ketamine for these procedures?
Well, ketamine can contribute to increased delirium after the seizure, definitely increased blood pressure and heart rate that is exacerbated by the sympathetic stimulation, and may increase ICP. Ketamine is an interesting medication that we're exploring for many uses for depression, and there are patients who respond to ketamine infusions, though some of that effect is short-lived. And in fact, the FDA is about to approve intranasal ketamine as a treatment for depression, which is going to make it much more widely available and not dependent on IV infusion. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that and how that impacts the overall treatment of depression.
Interesting. Okay. And then, you know, I would imagine in the past you really probably tried to stay away from rocuronium as a muscle relaxant because of how long it would last, even a while before you could even reverse. Now with the advent of Sugammadex in the United States, are you using rocuronium for some patients?
We're typically using succinylcholine unless there's a contraindication, because it works well and it's easily titratable. In rare circumstances, if we have patients with an allergy, with hyperkalemia, and one patient that I can think of in the recent past who had pseudocholinesterase deficiency, which was actually unmasked during her first ECT treatment, In those cases, we would use rocuronium, and it is a very nice advantage to have Sugammadex now as a reversal agent. In the past, it was difficult to time the relaxation such that the patient was relaxed during the procedure but not profoundly relaxed afterwards, that they were still reversible. As you know, with glycopyrrolate and neostigmine, we're having an enormous impact on an already dysregulated autonomic system as a result of the ECT stimulus. So that becomes a little bit more difficult to judge. How much glycopyrrolate do you give in order to have a desirable heart rate without having a lot of the parasympathetic side effects, undesirable parasympathetic side effects from the neostigmine.
Absolutely. All right. And then in terms of like other adjunct drugs, you mentioned that sometimes for blood pressure control, especially in people you really don't want them to get hypertensive, you might use nitroglycerin. For people you really want to control that heart rate and not have them get very tachycardic, esmolol or even labetalol if you need some longer acting action. Are there other things that you sometimes use as adjuncts?
Yes. We certainly for post-operative concerns, post-ECT concerns, things like nausea, muscle aches, myalgias are common, and we use Zofran, we use Toradol, we use a variety of other antiemetics, just as you would in any other sort of PACU situation. We do have a number of patients. This is going back to our conversation on catatonia, which is treated effectively with benzodiazepines. We have patients who come in who are on benzodiazepines chronically, and we need to reverse those before we can do the ECT treatment. So flumazenil is another common medication that we use in ECT that's not widely used in other anesthesia practice. To reverse the benzodiazepine effect prior to initiating the treatment. And then we do use benzodiazepines after the treatment for a variety of reasons, either to redose a patient who's on chronic benzos or to treat post-ictal delirium and agitation, which is quite common. So that's another common medication that we use.
Great. Now, you mentioned that almost all these patients are getting just mask ventilated during the procedure. Are there any other options? I guess you said someone who has an unavoidable full stomach, you might actually intubate. Anytime you use an LMA or anything else?
If they have a difficult airway, we were having difficulty effectively mask ventilating them, it's possible that we would use an LMA because you can sort of seat that over the glottis and ventilate more effectively. Typically, we don't need to do that. And then in rare circumstances, there's a genuine concern about a full stomach and an aspiration risk.
Okay. Now, how about the seizure itself? That's induced with electricity, as you said. Anything to keep in mind about that?
So the typical treatment that we start with is a right unilateral stimulation. So that's the right temporal and then above at the top of the occiput. And what that helps us do is avoid stimulating the language areas. Patients who get left unilateral or bilateral ECT are much more prone to having a lot more delirium, confusion, word-finding difficulty, memory loss afterwards. If patients are not responding to the right unilateral treatments, then in some cases we do move to bilateral ECT, so it would be bitemporal stimulation. And so once the stimulus is administered, there's a small latent phase, and then there's a tonic phase, a short tonic phase, and then we see a clonic phase to the seizure. And our goal with the succinylcholine is to attenuate motor activity enough so that we're preventing injury and complications, but that we can still see a little bit of the underlying motor manifestation to judge length of seizure, in addition to using that EEG.
Mm-hmm.
If the patients have very high seizure thresholds, they may have short seizures. In order for an adequate treatment to occur, we need the seizure typically to be greater than 30 seconds. That's our goal. And if it's less than 20 seconds, we may re-stimulate a second time. On the other hand, if they have very long seizures and we're approaching 3 minutes and the seizure is not self-limited, which it typically is, in that case, we would stop that pharmacologically with midazolam, some other benzodiazepine, propofol would be appropriate, a small bolus of that, and that's typically effective. The risk with very long seizures is that patients can develop status epilepticus.
Mm.
And I have seen that once that was required multiple anti-convulsant agents in the neurocritical care unit before we resolved that issue. But that's not typical, and that patient did have an organic focus for seizure activity as well.
Okay. And then once the seizure is over, what does the recovery look like?
So after the seizure is over, their patients are typically still a little bit weak from the succinylcholine, and so we need to support their airway and support their breathing primarily. We also treat hemodynamic perturbations, the heart rate and tachycardia and hypertension that we've mentioned. And we, typically in a few minutes, can get those parameters controlled, and either with medication, or they're just sort of self-limited perturbations that resolve on their own. We support their airway until they're breathing well and protecting their airway and ventilating well on their own. And then typically they can go to the recovery room at that point. But in some cases, we do have to be cognizant of post-op agitation and post-op delirium. And patients who've had longer seizures are at higher risk for that. Patients with polysubstance abuse, certainly that increases their risk. Concurrent use of lithium is also a risk factor for that. So sometimes you can meet a patient and understand that they fit a profile for that and may require some prophylactic sedation after the seizure is over, with typically benzodiazepines, midazolam, or lorazepam if you need something a little bit longer acting. But sometimes that postictal agitation can be a surprise, so we're always vigilant for that. And certainly history of postictal agitation increases the risk that it will occur again.
Okay. So you've mentioned delirium, postictal agitation, kind of some of the other usual side effects of any procedure, like post-op nausea and vomiting, need for airway support. Are there other complications unique to ECTs that we should keep in mind?
Well, we're using the succinylcholine to blunt things like myalgias and some musculoskeletal issues, but those are certainly of concern if the succinylcholine dose is inadequate or if the patient is very frail. When we stimulate, we're stimulating close to the masseter muscle, and there's a pretty strong reaction where the jaw clenches. And so we do use a bite block, a soft rubber bite block that fits between the teeth, and that's in an attempt to protect the patient from tongue laceration, dental injury, injury to the soft tissue and lips. But that can be that can also happen.
And just to be clear, the reason that they do that, even though they have succinylcholine on board, is because the electricity is directly stimulating that muscle.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's obviously, those things are important to keep in mind. We already talked about the hemodynamic potential side effects, things like tachycardia and hypertension, especially important in people who are at risk for myocardial ischemia. You mentioned that the initial parasympathetic phase can cause increased secretions, which I imagine puts people at risk for laryngospasm.
That's correct. Increased secretions, we can see laryngospasm from time to time, and exacerbation of bronchospasm and wheezing afterwards. That's on the sort of the parasympathetic side of the equation. And then in terms of prolonged sympathetic side effects, we do typically see hypertension and tachycardia, but there can also be issues with arrhythmias.
Mm-hmm.
A few patients that have had complications with myocardial ischemia or new onset of atrial fibrillation as a result of ECT. So we're really kind of stirring everything up, and some people have a tendency towards parasympathetic complications, others towards sympathetic complications.
Okay. And then you mentioned before awareness, that's a risk and a worry. What is that common?
I think it's more common than we think it is in ECT. It's probably underreported. When I have patients who have concerns with awareness, I always go and follow up and talk to them about their experience. And because they have concurrent psychiatric illness, sometimes it can be difficult to tease out awareness from maybe another experience that they've had where they recall waking up, or they recall moments before they went off to sleep and are conflating those things.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are some patients who just have frank psychotic features as elements of their depression, and the situation that they experienced has very little to do with what actually happened during the procedure. But in the event that it is does genuinely seem like they had recall about something that happened during the procedure, that could happen because they were received muscle relaxant before they were completely anesthetized. It could also happen because they were beginning to emerge before the seizure then reinduced unconsciousness. And we're always doing our best to facilitate a good seizure and a good treatment. So we are very carefully titrating those medications for just the minimal depth of anesthesia that we need for this type of procedure. So while awareness under general anesthesia is rare, and ECT is not viewed as one of the major contributors to this incidence, it is something that we see from time to time and take very seriously, and when it does happen, involves quite a lot of patient reassurance and then reevaluation of the medication doses and the risk-benefit for them continuing ECT if this has the potential to happen again.
Great. So say a little about, you've made this a focus of your clinical practice. What is it about it that you find really interesting and kind of has made you want to focus on this?
I find it interesting that every single time the recipe is different, mm-hmm. Or could be different. Each patient has their own, sort of unique background in terms of the psychiatric medications there are, where they are at their stage in their depression, if they're very depressed or if they're starting to get better. And all of these contribute to their level of consciousness and how responsive they are to the anesthetic drugs that we give. It involves a direct conversation between the anesthesia provider and the psychiatrist about how they're doing clinically, what their seizure course has looked like, and what we need to do to optimize their treatment. And that comes from the choice and dose of anesthetic medications, as well as the extent of hyperventilation, when to stimulate. And so that's always an interesting sort of conversation, especially with patients who where it's a little bit more difficult to achieve a good response easily with the typical medications and typical doses. And beyond that, it's a very collegial environment. We have a great relationship with the psychiatric nursing staff and the psychiatry staff. We get a lot of very interesting medical consults as well, and trying to figure out the appropriate course of action for each patient and how we're going to optimize some patients who have significant comorbidities, medical comorbidities in addition to their psychiatric issues, and optimize them for treatment, but get them through their acute course of depression and get them feeling better is challenging but rewarding.
Sounds really interesting. Anything else you think we should touch on before we sign off?
I think that's about it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much to Dr. Miller. I thought that was really interesting. Took me back. I haven't done ECT in a long time, but go to the website, acrac.com, and let us know what you thought. You can leave a comment. Everyone else can learn from what you have to say. What is your approach to anesthesia for ECT? Let us know. If you're a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. And if you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. If you prefer to make pledges when and where and how you most desire, whenever you want, then you can instead go to paypal.me/acrac. That's paypal.me/accrac. And you can make a donation now, later, anytime you want. Either way, we are really appreciative. Thank you so much to those of you who have already made donations. And of course, big thanks to Brian Park for the outlines that he does. You'll see popping up on some of the episodes. All right. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Christina Miller, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.